So the plan for today is to talk about bundles and fields, which is the way we're going to talk about vector fields, covector fields, tensor fields on a manifold. There's just one tiny thing left to say from last time about tensor fields on manifolds, tensors on manifolds. So just to finish that up, we had defined tensors on a vector space in general. The last piece of the puzzle is to say that if M is a manifold, then the space of all tensors of rank RS on the manifold, which we define like this, is simply all the tensors of rank RS on at the point A, because this is all at the point, is a set of tensors based on the tangent space. So we use the vector space, that's the one that we're building the tensors on, to be this one. In general, we said if V is a vector space, we define TRS of V as a set of tensors on the vector space. And for a manifold, we use the tangent space at the space. And then if you have a coordinate chart U phi, with phi being of the form x1 to xn, if we want to look at the basis of this space, which we know is a vector space, as we've seen last time. So a basis for this space is going to come up by taking the tensor product of the basis of the tangent space and the one of the cotangent space. So in general, you're going to have d over dxi1 tensor d over dxi2. All of these are at the point, and so on. And then we have tensor dxj1a tensor all the way to dxjs. And because the indices, there's R indices times S indices, in general, the dimension of this thing is going to be the dimension of M, because that's how many indices you can have. Each of them goes from 1 to n if n is the dimension of M. And then we multiply these, we take it to the power R times S. Or maybe it should be, it's R plus S. Because we have R plus S possible indices. So this gives us a dimension of the vector space, and that's everything we have left to say about tensors of manifolds. Once we know the tangent space, all the other spaces are easy because they just come from that one. Just like the cotangent space was this one, then we take the dual. The tricky one is the tangent one, because we need to actually define tangent vectors. Okay, so this is this finishes really the last lecture. Are there any questions about these or things that we talked about last week? Okay, so at this point, we know what vectors are, covectors are, and more generally tensors are at a single point. So all of this is at a point A in M. If we want to talk about things that are more interesting than these, such as vector fields, then we need to have a notion of mapping. So we want something like this. We want a map that takes A in M and associates to it some vector xA in TAM. So we would like to take a point, associate a vector, and then another point, another vector, in a smooth way. The problem is that we don't know what it means for this thing to be smooth. This thing has a smooth structure, but where does this thing live in? Because this space depends on the point itself. So I cannot really say what the codomain of this function is, because it's going to be what the collection of all tangent spaces. It kind of is, but not quite exactly. And there's the problem of how do we define this map to be smooth? Because so far we can do that for functions from Rn to Rm or to manifolds, but this thing here is not a manifold yet. So in order to talk about whether a vector field that is a map that assigns to each point a vector tangent to the point is smooth, we need to make the possible tangent vectors, all of them, to the manifold. We need to make them into a manifold themselves. This kind of thing is called a bundle, which is it's a more general notion that we're going to see later in the course in the general form. So for now, I'm just going to give you the specific ones. So we'll start with tangent vectors. So the tangent bundle, the idea is, as I was saying, we want the codomain of the function. And because we can have tangent points are all kinds of points, we need to put all of them together. The tangent bundle is such a thing. So we define it as, the name is TM. We essentially remove the point A because it doesn't depend on the specific point anymore. And it's going to be the disjoint union for all points in the manifold of the set that contains A only times TAM. Disjoint union of this thing, which is what I defined. Disjoint union means that we're taking the union of things, but we want to make sure that they are distinct. So suppose you want to take the disjoint union of R with itself. If you take the union, you just get R, because that's it. R is itself, so if you take the union, it doesn't change. But if you take the disjoint union, you somehow treat things that are the same as disjoint. One way of doing this is by taking the regular union for A in M, and then we label each of these points, each of these tangent spaces, by A, which is the point we're considering. So to do this, we take the set that has only A inside and take the Cartesian product with TAM. So you can think of these as just adding a little bit of extra piece of information to the vector space that tells us where it lives. The reason why we do this is that TAM is a vector space. It doesn't know that it's a vector space with tangent points, tangent vectors at A. Even though the name we gave it has an A in it, the vector space with the vectors inside it and the structure doesn't know about this. So we need to explicitly tag it with this piece of information. So this is pretty much taking the union of the spaces, but additionally, we're adding this extra piece of information. And the reason why we do it is that if you think of Rn as a manifold, for example, and you try to do this, all the tangent spaces are exactly the same place. They're all the derivations at the point, but they all look the same. So if you take the union, you add only one of them, but you want to distinguish them. And the next step is making this thing into a manifold. Because now the point is going to be a vector field is a map that goes from the manifold to this place that contains all possible vectors. But we want to make it smooth. And to make it smooth, we need differential structures on M, which we have, and on this place, which we don't have. And just to make things even more explicit, this is the set of all possible pairs A, V, such that A is in the manifold, and V is tangent at A. So So making this into a manifold means for each point in here, I want to give it coordinates. And then we need to do it in such a way that we patch them nicely. So any ideas of how we can give coordinates to this pair? What coordinates would you give to the first entry of this pair? Yes?
Whatever is the chart of your...
Yes, right. So whatever coordinate it has in M, give it those coordinates. We know how to give coordinates to things in M. And if V is a vector, how do we give it coordinates? Yes?
Map basis vectors to standard basis.
Yes, you map the basis vector to the standard basis. Essentially, if I give you a basis, then any vector is decomposed with components in terms of the basis. And those components are exactly things that live in Rn. They're numbers. So those are your coordinates. And specifically, we're going to choose the coordinate basis of TAM, because those are induced by the coordinates. So to formalize things, if U phi lives in the atlas of M, then we define a new atlas induced by this, which I want to call U tilde phi tilde, in the atlas for the tangent bundle. And we define it this way. U tilde is going to be the disjoint union for A in U of TAM. So instead of taking the whole thing, we only take the tangent spaces that are tangent at points in U. So this will be the set of all the A, V, such that A is in U, V is in TAM. And then phi tilde is going to act on a pair A, and the vector V, I'm just going to write it directly in a basis, VI D over DXI A. Any vector can be written in such a form because that's a basis. And the coordinates of these are just going to be phi of A and then V1, V2, all the way to Vn. And this lives in R1. And then you just go and do this for every chart. We're not going to go through the steps, but it's not difficult to show that this is indeed an atlas. You can see that the transition functions work. And that's because the map that takes A to phi of A is a regular nice chart that we already knew. And the one that takes these to this is a linear map. It's the linear map that goes from the vector space to Rn. And we know that it's an isomorphism because it's invertible. And linear maps are also always smooth if you use the usual notion of smoothness on Rn. So this tells us that Tm is a manifold of dimension 2 times the dimension of M. Here, when I wrote N, I was already assuming that M has dimension N. That's why we have N components for the vectors. So really, this should be dimension of M plus dimension of the tangent space, but those have the same dimension of M. So we made TM into a manifold, which means now we're able to talk about fields. So a vector field, actually, I need to tell you one more piece of information before we can talk about vector fields. There's one extra thing that we can add to the tangent bundle, and it's called the natural projection. This is something that's a property of bundles. Bundles are sets that have some properties, and one of them is that they have a projection. The projection is a map that we usually call pi that goes from the tangent bundle to the manifold itself. And the way it works, it's a projection because it essentially projects, well, not essentially, exactly what it does. It projects the first coordinate of this pair down to M. So this maps the pair AV into M to A. So it's a projection because it gives us the first coordinate out of two. Just as if you have two coordinates, x and y, or maybe x, y, z, maybe easier. If you have x, y, z, and then you only keep x and y, you're projecting down on the plane. OK, so this is needed in order to define a notion of fields. Okay, so vector field, this is a preliminary notion. I'm going to give you a better notion later. So it's going to be some smooth map that goes from the manifold to Tm. But we also need one extra piece of information. And that's why we need the projection, such that the projection composed with x is the identity map on M. Or another way of writing it is that pi of x of A equals A. This is less weird than it looks. Essentially, what this is telling us is that, in general, x of A is going to belong to Tm. So x of A looks like this. Bv will be in M, V in Tbm. But for this to be the idea of a vector field that we have in mind, that at each point A associate a vector tangent to A, then we must have B equals A, which is exactly what this is asking. The projection of x of A, which is B, must be A. So that's all we're asking. We're simply saying this vector field is such that at each point associates the point itself and the vector tangent to the point. So this is not quite what we were looking for up there, a map that assigns A to xA directly. But if we do that, we don't have a way of knowing whether it's smooth. If we do this, we do. So it's a small price to pay. And additionally, this notion of Tm, the one that also includes the coordinates, actually has some benefits specifically for physics. So this is just an aside, but you're going to see this at some point later in the course. Tm, let's define some things first. So if M is the set of all points that the particle can take, so for example, you have a particle, or say the pendulum. You have the pendulum, and the set of all possible points that the pendulum can be at is a sphere, if you think of a pendulum in R3. And that's a manifold. So generally, unless you're doing weird things, we end up with manifolds when you look at all possible spaces that a particle can be in. You usually impose some constraints. You start from R3, then you impose some constraints, and you end up with something which is a manifold. And if this is the case, then Tm is the configuration space of Lagrangian mechanics. Because this is a set of points, it's a set of things will look like this. Well, I already wrote it, but let's write it again. So when you think of it like this, this is a set of all points and vectors tangent at the point. But vectors tangent at the point can be interpreted as velocities because they are, as you see, so in the tutorial, you can think of them as being the tangent to the curves. So you can just interpret this space as just being the set of all possible positions and velocities that you can have. And that's the configuration space of Lagrangian mechanics. So if you want to do Lagrangian mechanics on manifolds, actually TM is exactly what you want. So this fact that it has this extra A that can be sometimes annoying is actually great because that tells us something else. Otherwise, you would need to do something different than TM. Any questions? OK, we'll get back to fields once I tell you about the cotangent bundle and the tensor bundles. So I'll give you more examples and a more general definition than this one. The cotangent bundle is just the same thing as the tangent bundle, but for the cotangent space. Once we have done one of them, the other ones get very easy because they all look the same. So this one we call just T star M, and this is going to be the disjoint union for A in M of T star A M. So same thing as before, and again, we can give it an atlas and make it into a manifold. So this time we see that U tilde is going to be the disjoint union A in M, A in U of T star A, M, same as before. And now the map phi tilde is going to take A and some covector, which we can write in a basis like this. So just as we did over there, we take the, actually over there, we take the basis of the cotangent space, which was given by these functions dxi, that's the dual basis to the one. And this is just going to be phi of A. And then we just get alpha 1 to alpha n. So again, the dimension of T star M is just going to be 2 times the dimension of M. So this is pretty much the same as that. I just changed the basis of the vector space I'm looking at. But it works just in the same way. And it's just the same for tensors, but we have more choices because we can take in general type RS. So I'm going to give it this notation, TRS M without the point A is going to be, again, the disjoint union of these bundles, these tensor spaces at the point A. Again, U tilde is going to be disjoint union only on U. And I need a bit more space for this one. Phi tilde of point A and then a tensor can always be written in a basis like this. So we have T I1 to IR J1 to JS. And then remember, at the very beginning, I told you what the basis in coordinates was for the tensor space. So we need to write it as d over dx I1 at A times, and so on. And then we have dx j1 at A, and so on. It's just more annoying to write out, but it's exactly the same idea as this. I just wrote a generic tensor in terms of the basis. Yes?
Sorry, I'm not sure how to think of this like tensor bundle, because so for a tangent bundle, right, I imagine, at least like geometrically, imagine these as like some planes, or
yes,
in a very simple case, right, you have these planes and you put them together, but in this case TRSAM is a space of RS rank,
yes,
right, and that could be any RS tensor, and then you're taking, so there's, what I'm saying is, like, there's no geometric interpretation, right?
There isn't.
Okay.
It's an algebraic thing. When you take tensor products of things, that's an algebraic thing. I'm just telling you, you have two vector spaces, and algebraically, you can define a new one that does a certain thing. So I don't have a geometric intuition of what this is. The tangent space is special because it has a geometrical intuition, because it's tangent vectors. Already the cotangent one doesn't have a geometrical intuition because it's the dual of the tangent space, which again is an algebraic thing. You can try to give some notion geometrically, but in the end it's the dual of the tangent space. So whatever kind of geometric thing you give it comes from the tangent space itself. So that's the one that has the actual geometrical information. The other ones are just algebraic constructions done on the tangent one. And they are helpful for, well, a variety of reasons. The cotangent bundle is extremely important because it allows us to talk about differential forms, which make a lot of things easier than talking about non-differential forms. And also we'll see, when I told you earlier that TM was the configuration space of Lagrangian mechanics, we'll see that T star M is the configuration space of Newtonian mechanics. The one is not obvious. I mean, I can tell you now that that's true, but I cannot convince you yet. For this one, I can convince you because of the geometrical interpretation. The tangent vectors are tangent, so they are velocities of curves. Covectors, I can tell you that they're momentum, but it doesn't make any sense. It will only make sense once we see symplectic manifolds. Okay, so once you have this, again, you just associate to this point as coordinates, the coordinates of A and the components of the tensor in these spaces. So now we're going to get phi of A, and then all of these things I'm going to put them in a matrix. So in general, you get something like this. So with these notions, you can define both the cotangent bundle and the tensor bundles, all kinds of them. And then, using exactly the same idea as before, we can talk about covector fields and tensor fields in general. Is what we're going to do right now. But I told you that I was going to give you a more general definition. So the problem with the definition is that I assume that the vector field is defined everywhere on the manifold. It goes from M to TM. More generally, we would like to talk about local vector fields. So we can do things such as X that goes from a subset U in M to TM. The problem is that we still want to talk about smoothness. And to do this, we need to require that this subset is open. And the problem with that, and the reason why I didn't do that before, is that I didn't tell you what the open sets of M are. We kind of managed to avoid that up until this point. So let's go through the definition of what it means to be open. I'm just going to tell you, we're not going to go into the details, because if you really want to understand what's happening, you need topology, and then we need another course, and we only have one course. But the idea is the following. So we're trying to define what does it mean to be an open set on a manifold. So suppose you have a chart U phi. Which I will just see as it belongs in the atlas for M. Then if W is an open subset of phi of U, which lives in Rn, which means this is an open subset in Rn. Those ones we know how to visualize and imagine them. We know all about this. If you know about topology, we're choosing the standard topology on Rn. If you don't, just think open sets as you know them from calculus. So if W is an open set in Rn, then phi to the minus 1 of W is open in M. This is just by definition. So we're going to say that if something is mapped to an open set, well, really, if something is the pre-image of an open set using the charts, then it's open. And additionally, and this is the thing about topology that we must do, we are also going to say that the empty set is open. And then if A and B are subset of M and they're open, then A intersection B is open. And then if you have a collection of open sets, and this can be any collection, can be infinite, it can be uncountable, it doesn't matter. If this is a collection of open things, then the union of all of these things is still open. I don't have time to explain why these things are true. Actually, I can't. They're a definition, so you can really explain why they're true. You can try to explain why they make sense. But these things define the notion of a topology. A topology is a collection of open sets that you add on a space, and it must satisfy these things. It also must satisfy that M is open itself, but this one comes from the fact that this is true, and then the atlases covered everything. So don't worry about this thing too much. We're not going to worry about the actual topological aspects, but this is just for completeness. More easily, if you are thinking of a manifold embedded into Rn, such a sphere, you can think of an open set on the sphere as being something which is an open set in Rn intersected with the sphere. So for example, you look at the sphere and then you look at points like this, you can think of this as being an open set. You don't need to go through the whole construction using the charts and so on. You know what's open on a sphere, you can just think of it usually. So this is just for things that don't really have a notion of being open. Okay, so now that we have this notion, then if this thing is a map that goes from an open subset of M to Tm, and it is mod, and pi composed with x is the identity on U, then this thing is what we call the vector field. This is more general because U can also be M itself, so then we get the global ones from before, but this one is a local vector field. this is going to be more useful in practice because often you cannot find global vector fields that have some property that you want. And also, if you look at the coordinate representation of, and the basis in terms of coordinates, something like this, right now this is at one point. We would like to be able to extend it as a vector field. So at each point, we get d over dxi a. But that's necessarily, by construction, not global, because that's only going to be true in a chart. And charts are open by definition. If you follow this definition, the chart itself is open. So you need to use a local notion. So we need this local notion to make things more interesting. Any questions at this stage? Okay, so once we know vector fields, covector fields and tensor fields are just the same. So if alpha goes from some subset, which is open in M, to T star M, and then you have the projection composed with alpha is the identity in U, then this is a local covector field. These things are also called one-forms. We're going to talk about those, I think, at the end of this week. And those of you taking the gravitational physics course probably have seen these ones already, and you probably have seen one-forms anyway, but in case you haven't, these things are also called one-forms. They are a specific case of the general notion of differential forms. And then, same way, a tensor field is some smooth map from a subset which is open on M to TRS M. And again, the projection must be the identity. And by the way, this notion here, once we see bundles, this is what identifies the thing we call section of the bundle. Right now, just a name, but that's a specific property that gives such a map a specific connotation. And in our case, it can be interpreted as a field. But bundles can be something more general than something like this. OK, so we know almost everything we need to know about bundles. So just one final thing that I want to tell you. And it's an abuse of notation. This is just to solve the problem that I told you about before, that ideally, if you would like your map to give you, for each point, a vector. But right now, for each point, it gives us a pair of the point itself and the vector, which can be annoying. So often, we identify x of a, which is going to be the pair a, and I usually denote it by this, x with the subscript a, which is the actual vector at the point, with x of a. By which I mean, sometimes if, say, you have a map that takes a vector as input, you feed it x of a, which is a pair, instead of x subscript a, which is a vector. Just because otherwise the notation gets super messy and just too much. So that's something we do to overcome this problem. But as I showed you earlier, this problem is not always a problem. Sometimes it gives you useful features. And we're going to exploit them in Lagrangian and Hamiltonian mechanics. Yes?
I didn't understand. So you have this property of a local vector field is that if you do the natural projection composed of the vector field, you get the identity on an open subset, right?
Right, so you're asking the factor mixed into these two local subset is that the identity, when you do pi composed with x, you're going to get something which is the identity on the open subset itself.
Yeah, so in your definition of a vector field, you already have the natural projection
Yes.
Not
right, so you're asking what's the difference between that definition and this definition, pretty much.
Yeah.
The difference is that I am allowing this. I'm allowing the field to only be defined on a subset.
Oh.
So that's what I mean by local instead of global.
Okay.
Instead of being something defined everywhere, it's something defined on a subset. Now, I didn't give you the details. The reason why we asked for this to be open is that if U is an open subset of M and you have a chart on M, then you can take the chart and make a chart for U. Just because of the properties of the chart, there's always stuff about open sets. If U is not open, then you cannot just take a chart from M and put it into U easily.
Okay. So if you have a vector field, that defines a local vector field for each open set.
Yes. Yes. So if you have a global one, then you can always restrict it locally. But if you have a local one, you cannot always extend it globally. That's why this is more general. And also, this includes the case because M is open. So you can also think of a global field. It's also local. It's just it's local everywhere.
Why do you say it's more general? Because it's not a unique way to extend it?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
You said this is more general. Why?
Yeah, it's more general because the previous case is included because M is open. Because M is open, you can always say, okay, U equals M, so this thing is everywhere defined. But also, it allows you to define the field locally only, which the one doesn't. The one assumes that the field is always defined everywhere, and in some cases, you just can't define a field everywhere. Like in the case of the coordinates field, which I think we're going to have actually time to look at today. I guess in case you wanted more information on why exactly we're doing this, technically, I could have done something different and said, I only work on a submanifold of M. The problem with that is that I need to tell you where the submanifold is, and we don't have time. So instead of telling you about submanifolds, I tell you about open things because those are trivial submanifolds. You don't have to go through the whole trouble of defining submanifolds, which is not as obvious as you might think, because open things are easy. You just take a chart from M, restrict it to U, you intersect U with all of the sets for your chart, and everything ends up being open and everything is fine. Any other questions? Okay, so I think we have enough time to talk about frame fields. Before I tell you what the frame field is, let's notice two things about these spaces. I'm just going to work with the tangent space because the other things just follow just the same. So for example, in TM, we note that if see, x and y, or probably best if I give name to things. So I'm going to call gamma TM u. Oh, there's a comma here. This is going to be the set of all the vector fields that are defined on the subset U only. Just so I wanted to write this all the time. Now, this thing is a vector space. Guess how we're going to make this into a vector space.
Could you repeat?
Guess how we're going to make this set into a vector space. We need to give it operations. How do we define the operations on these things? Yes?
Pointwise.
Yes, it's always the same thing. It's always something pointwise. So if I need to say x plus y, I define this at point A as being, now this is supposed to be a pair, so I'm going to have A as the first thing, because I still want it to be a field, so it still needs to project down to A. And then for the other thing, I take xA, which is, here I'm assuming that x of A equals A xA, and y of A equals A yA. And then here I just do xA plus yA. And similarly, alpha times x at A is going to be A alpha times xA. So by doing this, this becomes a vector space. But this is more than a vector space. It has an extra additional thing that we can do. And that's the following. If if f is in C infinity, u r. So f is a function that goes from u to r and is smooth. Then we can also multiply f by a vector field. So these vector fields can be multiplied by scalars, but also by functions. And again, we define things pointwise. F times x evaluated at A is going to be A, and then we get f evaluated at A times x evaluated at A. And we're not going to go through all the steps because, again, they're not super complicated. But you can see that because f is smooth, this map is still smooth. So you still get a smooth vector field. Yes?
Is it x evaluated at A or xA?
You're right. This is xA. Which is the vector at the point, yes. So we can do this because at every point, fA is a number, and we can always multiply a number by xA. If you're interested, this makes the whole thing into what's called a C infinity UR module, rather than just a vector space. But it's just a name, it's not important for us. So this makes this space, the space of all local vector fields, into a vector space. Now, ideally, we would like to find the basis of this space. The problem is that this is a space of functions, and spaces of functions have the problem of mostly being infinite dimensional. So that's not great. So we cannot just find the basis. What we can do is find something that looks like a basis. So what we would like to do is find n vector fields that generate everything else. That will be the goal. That's what is called a frame. And now remember when I told you earlier that in general, you may not be able to find a global vector field. That's why we define local ones. This is very true for frames. Generally speaking, you cannot find a global frame. You cannot find n globally defined vector fields which generate everything else. But locally, you can. But I'm jumping ahead a little bit. So let me first tell you what these things are.
Thank you.
By definition, a local frame on M is a set EI from 1 to n, so we have n things, with each EI is an element, but let me write it explicitly. EI is a map that takes A in M and maps it to A EI K in TM. So it's a collection of n vector fields locally defined. Sorry, I should have said this is U. So this is only defined on a subset, the local ones, such that if you look at each point, these form a basis. So we're mapping at each point, we're giving a pair, which is the point itself and the vectors. And if you look at each point, all of the vectors that you get from all of these maps, they form a basis for the tangent space. Yes?
Is the dimension of M, right?
Yes. So let me write it. The dimension of M equals N. And similarly, the dual coframe, once you have a frame, we can always look at its dual. And this is going to be now a set of, let me call it epsilon I. These ones are going to be map. They take A nu and associate to them a pair A epsilon I at A. This time they're going to be things in T star M. And because it's the dual frame, this is such that at each point, epsilon I A is the dual basis to EI. Now, the reason why we did all this is that these things form kind of like a basis for vector fields. Because if I have a vector field x, then because at each point these things form a basis, at each point, I can say, well, x of A is going to be A, x, A. But x, A lives in the tangent space, which means that this is going to look like this. A, and then I have x, A, I, E, I, A. And if I define the function that takes A in U, let me give it a name. If I define the function xi that takes A in U, it associates to it xi A, which is a real number, then because the vector field is smooth, this map is smooth, which means that xA can be written by multiplying this function by the frame fields. And also we have to sum over the indices. So in general, we can write this as, without the A, we just write x equals xi times ei. But only when you restrict it to U. And if x is already defined only on U, fine. If x is defined on something bigger than U, we can locally write in terms of this. So even things that are defined everywhere on the manifold, locally we can write them like this. maybe not globally. So that's the idea of frame fields, and the cofields are the same thing for differential forms. If alpha lives in gamma t star m, then alpha restricted to u is going to look like alpha I epsilon I, where alpha I is a smooth function from u to r. Yes?
How does the local frame solve the infinite basis problem for C infinity?
Because you can kind of write things as a basis, right? When you have a basis, you usually do, okay, so I have a vector, and I'm going to write this vector as coefficients times the basis elements. This is not quite true, because the basis is infinite. But because we are allowed to multiply by functions, I can say that x is going to be a function, a set of functions multiplied by the basis vectors. So it looks like writing things in a basis, but the coefficients are functions instead of being numbers. So that's how it solves it. You can get your familiar notion of I have n things that generate everything else without being a basis, because technically they're not a basis. The basis is infinite because you can always, these things associate at each point a basis, but you can always change them. You could, for example, increase their size. As you move through the manifold, you make them bigger and bigger, these vectors. They are still a basis, but they are, they're still a frame. They're a different frame, but you can still write everything in terms of it.
Thank you.
Yes?
Is it always possible to have a local frame for an open?
Yes, you can always find the local frame. And that's because, and that's the last thing I want to tell you for today, there's a special local frame that's given by your coordinates. If we have the coordinates u, and then the chart is given by xi, x1 to xn, then remember those, the basis of the tangent space that we had? We always said that subscript a every time. Now I'm going to get rid of it. I'm going to say that d over dxi is the map that goes from, takes a in u, which is an open subset of m, and associates to this the pair a d over dxi at a, which lives in tm. And these things are an example of a frame. Because at each point, all of these things, as we saw, form a basis for the tangent space. So this is a frame. And similarly, dxi, without the subscript, is now going to be a map from a in u. The maps a to d. So it maps this to a dxi with a subscript a, and this leaves into t star m. This is the dual coframe. So you can always locally find a frame and a coframe. If you find a frame, the coframe is just a dual. So really, it's, you can always locally find a frame. Globally, that's not true. So this thing here means that local frames always exist. Global frames don't. And in general, they don't. It's a very special thing for a manifold to have a global frame. Most manifolds don't admit global frames. So you can only locally write things this way. Of course, you can find different patches of global local frames that you kind of use to map things together, such as those. You can use coordinates, and you have local fields, and you have coordinates that cover everything. So you can always do this, and you can mix and match things. You can write one in terms of the other on the intersection, and so on. But this generally doesn't happen. Yes? Sorry, what's the reason why it can't?
Why we can't have it?
Okay, so at this point, just so it's clear, the lecture is over. So everything I'm doing now is just extra information. We'll cover this again if you need it. So if you need to go, that's okay. So the reason why this doesn't happen in general is that you can show, and I'll probably have you show this at tutorial at some point, that global frames, so existence of a global frame, is equivalent to asking that the tangent bundle is trivial. In terms of bundles, which I haven't told you what this means yet, but this means that Tm is diffeomorphic to m times Rn, which is something which is not usually true. If this is true, then there is a global frame. The global frame is the thing that gives you the diffeomorphism. So that's the reason why generally it doesn't happen. Bundles are generally not trivial. We'll cover this again. So again, anything I'm saying now, we'll do it again. So that you don't need to memorize these things. But a bundle is a way of generalizing the notion of the manifold Cartesian product with some space. But potentially that locally looks like this, but globally it doesn't. So it's a more general idea than these kind of things, which is very useful because it allows us to look at spaces that are way more interesting than just this. So an example of a bundle is the Möbius band, which I don't think I can give justice to by doing a drawing, but I'll try. So you would have something that looks like this. I think I did it. So if you look at a Möbius band locally, and I wrote it like a finite thing, but imagine that you can extend it to infinity. Or if you wanted, you remove the endpoints. So it's an open Möbius band. This thing, if you think of it as an infinite thing, kind of looks like the cylinder locally. But because it has a twist, it's not locally the same thing. Sorry, it's not globally the same thing. This can actually be seen as a bundle over the circle. And the trivial bundle over the circle is something like the cylinder. And something which is non-trivial is something like this, because there's some extra information that you can only see globally but not locally. So whenever you have things that look like this, they're very boring because you are saying that they just globally looks the same as they look locally. So if you look locally, you know everything because there's nothing interesting happening on the bigger picture. While something like this, if I don't show you this thing, you don't know if it's a circle, if it's a cylinder or a Möbius band. If I don't tell you that it wraps around itself and changes the orientation, then you have no idea of knowing just by looking at a little piece of it. So that's why you don't have global frames in general. Yes?
Can you have something, can you have a manifold that can't be covered by one single chart, but still have a global frame?
Yes. A good question. So you're asking, if you have a manifold that's covered by only one chart, that it's obviously a global frame, because if it has only one chart, you just use that one chart.
Yeah.
U is M itself, so you have a global frame automatically. Yeah. Yeah, so for example, the cylinder is one of those cases. It has a global chart, so it's obviously, it has a global frame. By the way, this notion is called being parallelizable. So the cylinder is parallelizable. The circle is parallelizable. The circle does not have a global, one chart. You need at least two charts for the circle.
Yeah.
And that's because the circle is topologically not the same as R. If you add only one chart, that would be boring because then it will need to be like R, but the circle is not. And the circle does admit a global vector field. So in fact, it turns out that the tangent space to the circle is isomorphic to the cylinder.
But that means you have to like...
Sorry, diffeomorphic.
That means you have like an overlap on the chart where the vector fields have to agree.
Yes, you can define a global vector field. That's the way you're doing it.
Okay.
That's one of the things that I'm going to ask you to do at one of the tutorials.
Yeah, okay.
It's not that difficult because it's a one-dimensional vector space, so you really just need to choose the... Well, sometimes you have to take linear combinations.
Okay.
It's not a super complicated thing. But then, for example, for the sphere, this doesn't work. The sphere is not parallelizable.
Yeah.
The only n spheres that are, I think it's the odd, it's S0, S1, S3...
S7.
S7, and I think that's it.
Yeah.
So of all the possible spheres, of all dimensions, only four of them have this property. And all the other ones don't.
Yeah.
So it's really not something obvious that this should be true. And in general, it's not. Because spaces are more interesting than this.